You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore.
You're listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9. My name is Steve Niebel. I'm sitting in for David Gilmore, who is on hiatus right now. Today we have Leslia Newman. She's the author of 75 books for readers of all ages, including A Letter to Harvey Milk, October Morning, A Song for Matthew Shepard. She's received many literary awards, including creative writing fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and Massachusetts Artists Foundation, two National Jewish Book Awards, and many, many more. Leslia has been with us before. She did two interviews with her about books that were more recent that dealt with the passing of her parents. Welcome, Leslia Newman.
Very nice to be back.
It's great to have you back. So why don't we just start off with something that you want to read?
Why don't I just start with the first poem in the book? This poem actually, which is called 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackboard, came about from a typo. I was actually trying to type out 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, Wallace Stevens' famous poem, because I was going to give it to my students. And then somehow that's not what came out when I typed. So I thought, wow, this must be the title of a new poem. So here it is. 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackboard. 1. Among 20 crowded classrooms, the only sound was the rat-tat-tat of the white stick of chalk against the black blackboard. 2. I was of three minds, like the multiple choice question with three incorrect answers scrawled upon the blackboard. 3. The eraser whirled across the blackboard. It was a small part of the pantomime. 4. A teacher and her classroom and her blackboard are one. 5. I do not know which I dread more, the start of the lesson or the end of the lesson, the blackboard covered with problems or just erased. 6. Foreign words filled the blackboard in a curled and swirling script. The shadow of the teacher paced to and fro. Her mood was indecipherable. 7. Oh, restless children at your wooden desks, why do you stare out the window at the sky? Do you not see the blank blackboard before you, waiting like a Buddha for your attention? 8. I know great lines from great poetry and my times table up through 12, but I know too that the blackboard is involved in everything I know. 9. When the blackboard disappeared from the front of the classroom, it marked the end of one of many eras. 10. At the sight of the cracked blackboard lying on the curb with the trash, even the most overworked, underpaid teacher would cry out sharply. 11. She dreamt she was back in her third grade classroom, and a great fear pierced her as she watched herself vanish into the bottomless black hole of the blackboard. 12. The classroom is empty. The blackboard must be lonely. 13. It was the end of the school year, all year long. We were graduating, and we were going to graduate. The blackboard sat covered in chalk dust.
It sounds like there's some personal experience there with blackboards and children.
Well, I was a child in a classroom with a blackboard, for sure. And I have taught before all ages writing workshops, so I'm very familiar with blackboards. And I actually loved clapping the erasers. I'm a certain age where we did that. And I love to, that was a special privilege to, some kids maybe saw it as punishment, but I love to erase the whole board and then go outside and clap the erasers together. It was really great.
Oh, that's an interesting sense of fun. I didn't ever have that experience, actually, even though I'm probably old enough to have. Where did you go to school at that time?
So I grew up in Brooklyn, and then for elementary school, and then we moved to Long Island for the second half of elementary school, junior high, and high school, and then I went to the University of Vermont. And then I went to Naropa Institute and apprenticed with Allen Ginsberg. And then after that, I've just been self-taught, taking workshops here and there, but mostly really spending so much of my life reading poetry, going to poetry readings, trying different things, imitations such as this, writing in forms, writing in rhyme, you know, just all kinds of things, because I feel like the more one experiments, the more one unearths one's inner creative genius.
How was the internship with Allen Ginsberg?
Allen was very kind. You know, he was very fussy about who he took on. So I felt very honored that he chose me to be his student. Most of his students were male. And he was very kind. And he was sometimes impatient, especially if you didn't do the work. But my job was to help him answer his mail. And in exchange for that, he would critique my poems. And, you know, I learned a lot from what he said about my poetry, but I also learned a lot, if not more, from how he lived his life. And this was, you know, way before the internet. So he got copious piles of mail. And he read every single letter and with the same complete attention. And he got letters from everybody, from, you know, a gay kid out in Texas who didn't know who else to write to important newspaper editors and politicians. And he had no sense of hierarchy. Everybody was the same. Everyone deserved his full attention. So that was a lesson that I really took to heart.
I got to say that he was a pretty big influence on me, just in his writing. I just a really marvelous poet. And I always found it interesting that he got around so much, that there's so much video of him with different people in different forums and things.
I think he was really one of the first, if not the first, poet as celebrity, you know, because he was known also for his activism, for his stance against nuclear power, for his being gay. So, he definitely was out and about. You know, he traveled with Bob Dylan and the Rolling Thunder Review. He did all kinds of things.
Right. Yeah. So you were a New Yorker for a very long time.
Well, until I left home, I was a New Yorker. And I still feel a New Yorker in my bones, even though I haven't lived there for a long time.
Yeah. That's kind of when people grow up there, it's like the old thing, you can take the boy out of New York, but you can't take New York out of the boy. I suppose that would be an appropriate...
Right. A boy of any gender.
Yeah, boy of any gender, exactly. Of course.
But, you know, I also, I lived in New York as an adult also, but, you know, I really admired the New York School of Poets like Frank O'Hara, Eileen Miles, the St. Mark's Poetry Project. So, yeah, I very much feel at home when I'm in New York and when I'm reading New York poetry.
Yeah, so you haven't picked out any particular poems that you want to read, have you?
Well, I could actually read you a New York poem.
Okay.
You know, what I like to do is, you know, we have a conversation and that will remind me of a poem that I want to read that fits right in, like this.
You bet.
So this poem takes place in Brooklyn, in the neighborhood where I grew up. It's called Ode to a Knish Shop. Mrs. Stahl sold Kasha Knishes, oy gavolt, were they delicious? To eat one was to have a feast, for each one weighed a pound at least. When I was young, they cost a nickel, cheaper than a kosher pickle. In Brighton Beach, beneath the L, seduced by that arresting smell, I'd take the last place in the queue on Coney Island Avenue, then perch upon a worn red stool and try my hardest not to drool as I watched Mrs. Stahl herself pluck kitches from a metal shelf and serve them piping hot with pride, the sign outside read, baked, not fried. The pastry bigger than my fist caressed my tongue like being kissed, so savory, so plump, so sweet, that knish knocked me right off my feet. The outside dough was parchment thin, yet strong enough to hold within buckwheat growth that smelled of earth and added inches to my girth. But in those days, I didn't care a whit about my derriere, that kasha knish was heaven sent, no nickel ever better spent.
You have a section of Lovely that is for food.
I do.
What is it? Ode to Chocolate.
Ode to chocolate, yep. Ode to mangoes, pear.
The ode to chocolate is that always. I thought of my wife. She. We have a chocolatier in the neighborhood, and we have a post office box. So we go to the post office and we drive right past the chocolatier. And by now, I ask, "Well, do we want to stop at Johnson's today?" You know, it's a regular thing. She'll go in and buy, you know, 5 or 6 pieces of her favorite chocolate and do that. It's been.
Maybe I should read Ode to Chocolate. I have to say that my love affair with chocolate has definitely escalated during the COVID crisis. So I think it's those things that offer comfort, right? That some of us have turned to, hopefully not in too much excess.
The upside of the pandemic.
Right. So this is written in form. It's a ghazal, which is a Persian form of poetry. It has an internal rhyme scheme and it has a refrain. So I'm sure you will pick up on that. Ode to chocolate. I need a sweet. I need a treat. I need to eat some chocolate. Dark as wood and so darn good. Oh, I could live on chocolate. Shaped like a kiss, delivers bliss, the deep abyss of chocolate. Just one bite, I'm up all night. Such is the might of chocolate. You'll never wed me, never bed me till you fed me chocolate. I'm sick and sure the only cure is more, more, more pure chocolate. The smallest bite brings huge delight, high as a kite from chocolate. I drink it hot right from the pot. What hits the spot? Why chocolate? A day without, I'm sure to pout and then shout, where's my chocolate? I must confess I'm one hot mess unless I possess chocolate. Without that cocoa, I go loco. This ain't no joke. Oh, chocolate. Before I dribble, I'll end this scribble and go and nibble chocolate.
We're doing the fun part of your book.
Yes, there are some parts that are not so much fun, but those are the fun parts.
Well, one of the poems that really struck me, that really hit me hard, was First Death. My thought about it was it's partly about the naivete and the cruelty of children. There's a certain reality that's there, you know, and it's, of course, you're not the first one to write something about that, but I thought that was really a hard-hitting piece of writing, and also the way that it develops. But I shouldn't talk about it too much, should I? We should just...
Maybe I should read it, and then we can talk about it.
Then we can talk about it. Let's do it that way.
Okay. So the poem is called First Death, and there's an epigraph which says, after the first death, there is no other. And that is something that was said by Dylan Thomas. On the day Mimi Schechter returned to us, we became the pack of wild animals our parents always said we'd grow up to be. Truthfully, we hadn't noticed she'd been gone for 6 months. Plain as the brown lunch sack she clutched in one hand, she stood out of our way as we did what kids do while waiting to be scooped up by a yellow school bus. The boys chased the girls worthy of being chased. The girls ran shrieking in terrified joy. And the rest of us pretended not to care, that no one cared enough about us to steal our books or pull our hair. Mimi Schechter swayed like a small tree trembling in the wind, her eyes wide in her pale, chalky face, looking much older than her scant 7 years. She wasn't as I remembered her, though I did not remember her at all. Somehow she had turned into her own grandmother, her features faded and her eyebrows completely gone like a lesson on the blackboard, recently erased. And her hair, it wasn't little kids' hair anymore. It was too perfect, smooth and sleek and straight, each strand turning under her chin just so, like those high-kicking raquettes all in a row. It's a wig, I thought, and as though Danny Lieberman could read my mind, he gave up chasing Amy Sabatelli, spun on his heels and snatched Mimi Schechter's wig with a whoop and a holler, throwing his prize straight up in the air. Mimi Schechter's hair hovered in the blue suburban sky, blocking out the sun for a split second before it fell like a shot bird. Another boy caught it and gave it back to Danny, who tossed it to another kid, who tossed it to another kid, while Mimi Schechter just stood there in all her bald-headed glory and despair. The sight was so frightening, it made someone shout, "Bowling head, bowling head," and not one of us had the courage to not join in. We laughed and tossed that wig back and forth, until someone caught sight of our school bus rounding the corner, and we all fell into an orderly line, except for Mimi Schechter, who ran home weeping. "Cry, baby, cry, baby," we called as each one of us walked past Mimi Schechter's wig, sprawled on the ground like an injured animal run over by one of our mother's cars. And that was that. Mimi Schechter never came back to school, and no one knew what happened to her until 2 months later, when the principal made a crackly request over the PA system after we'd said the Pledge of Allegiance, asking for a moment of silence for our good friend Mimi Schechter, who had just that morning died. Died? I didn't know anyone who was dead, and I ran home bursting with the news. "Mom, you'll never guess," I yelled, as if I'd received an A on my spelling test. My mother was in the kitchen, tethered to the phone, when I announced, "Mimi Schechter died," and then collapsed in a fit of giggles. She hung up quickly and stared at her beast of a daughter, now doubled over and howling with laughter like an unhinged hyena. I deserved the slap she gave me on behalf of Mimi Schechter. Mimi Schechter, who deserved a little respect from me. Mimi Schechter, whose tear-streaked face I still see. Mimi Schechter, my first death, November 18th, 1963.
I remember being a child, and I remember that there were children who the other children made fun of. Personally, I always felt an empathy for them and felt bad for them, because it never seemed to me like the reason that the other kids picked on them was their fault. I understood that poem. I suppose everybody understands that poem really well. Is that a true story?
It's true in the sense of it's filtered through a memory, you know, that is decades old. So I couldn't say that this incident happened exactly the way it did. But I can tell you that there was a little girl in my neighborhood who had cancer and who died. And it was very tragic. And I believe the part about me coming home and laughing, because it was announced, you know, the principal announced it over the loudspeaker. I think I was laughing, but, you know, I think it was really hysteria, because it was so frightening to think that a little kid, even younger than me, because I was older, you know, not that much older, but, you know, if you're 2 or 3 years older as a child, it's like a world different. You know, if mm-hmm. you're 60 or 63, it's nothing. But if you're, you know, 8 and 10, it's or 8 and 11, it's like a different world. But anyway, I just think I didn't know how to respond to this. And I think of that Joni Mitchell song, which has the lyrics in it, "Laughter and Crying," you know, it's the same release. I forget what song it is, but I think that's what was going on. I couldn't handle it. So that's just, you know, a response that wasn't calculated. I wasn't laughing on purpose. That's just what you know, sprung out of me. And my mother was horrified, and she didn't know any other way to calm me down. So that's what she did.
Yeah. Whether the story is true or not, in terms of the reader, doesn't necessarily have a lot of relevance, because it's the impact of the story that's important, and also the truth of it. Like I say, I'm sure that most people who remember grade school remember things like that,
It's emotionally true. I'll say that. It's definitely emotionally true.
Right.
And, you know, one thing that I feel bad about to this day is that I was teased a lot as a child for various reasons, you know, frizzy hair, chubby, that kind of thing. And whenever someone else was teased, I was so relieved that it wasn't me at that moment mm-hmm. that I didn't really join in. But just as importantly, I didn't do anything to stop it.
Yeah.
You know, and I do feel bad about that, because I knew what that felt like. It just felt so horrible.
Right. I hadn't really thought about it, about why I felt such an empathy for all, you know, all the way through school. Even in high school, I remember there were certain people who were at least excluded. I really appreciate that poem. I really appreciate that you wrote that. I think that kind of honesty takes a bit of courage, you know, so the reader is going to say, oh, Leslie Newman, I don't, you know, you naughty girl, you know, I don't know. I mean, I can imagine that you thought about that when you wrote it and were deciding whether to put that in a book or not. I don't know if you were or not. That's something that I would ask.
Well, you know, I also grew up reading the confessional poets, Sylvia Plath and Sexton. And I pretty much never shied away from bearing myself on the page. It's just, I think it's my job as a poet is to share my humanity. You know, the hope is that the reader will tap into their own humanity and find a common ground and feel something. Right. So that is what I'm trying to do.
Just doing your job.
Just doing my job. That's what they pay me the big bucks for.
Yeah, that's right. Really. Yeah. Another one of the poems that really hit me really hard was Teen Angels. There again, that is a truth. It's not, just not easy. That's not an easy poem. But I'd really like it if you read that and talked about
it. Sure. Sure. I'll read it first, then I'll talk about it. Teen Angels. Raymond Chase, Tyler Clementi, Billy Lucas, Asher Brown, Seth Walsh, Carl Walker Hoover. 19 years old, 18 years old, 15 years old, 13 years old, 13 years old, 11 years old. Raymond Chase, Tyler Clementi, Billy Lucas, Asher Brown, Seth Walsh, Carl Walker Hoover. Fag, faggot, fairy, sissy, homo, queer. Raymond Chase, Tyler Clementi, Billy Lucas, Asher Brown, Seth Walsh, Carl Walker Hoover. Punched, slapped, kicked, chased, tackled, stripped. Raymond Chase, Tyler Clementi, Billy Lucas, Asher Brown, Seth Walsh, Carl Walker Hoover. Ashamed, afraid, enraged, depressed, defeated, alone. Raymond Chase, Tyler Clementi, Billy Lucas, Asher Brown, Seth Walsh, Carl Walker Hoover. Hanged himself, drowned himself, hanged himself, shot himself, hanged himself, hanged himself. Raymond Chase, Tyler Clementi, Billy Lucas, Asher Brown, Seth Walsh, Carl Walker Hoover. Friend, brother, cousin, teammate, classmate, mama's boy.
Thank you. Where did that poem spring from?
I was the keynote speaker for Gay Awareness Week at the University of Wyoming in 1998, which the week that Matthew Shepard was murdered for being gay. So if any listeners don't know, Matthew Shepard was kidnapped from a bar, robbed, beaten, tied to a fence, and abandoned. And he was found 18 hours later by a mountain biker and brought to a hospital, but his body could not sustain such terrible injuries, and he died 6 days later, which was the day that I arrived on campus. I've been giving talks about LGBTQ rights ever since my book, Heather Has Two Mommies, came out in 1989. It feels like 1889. And I always start my talks tribute to Matthew Shepard. And as the years went on, I added other young men who were the victims of hate crimes to this talk. And in the LGBTQ community, we have this tradition called Say Their Names, so that when somebody's voice is silenced, when somebody's life is wiped out, they're not forgotten because we say their names. And as long as one person says their name, we remember them. And so that is why the names keep getting repeated, just keep saying their names. And as the poem goes on, you learn more about each character or real, they're all real people. And since listeners don't see the book in front of them, it's important for me to tell you that stanza, which is very, very hard for me to read, to say those words that can be said and are often said with hate, like fag, faggot, fairy, sissy, homo, queer, are in quotation marks. So it's very clear that those words are being hurled at these young men. It's not how they think of themselves. It's what they're called, and that's what drives them. And then furthermore, there's physical violence, punch, slap, kick, etc., Then it's how they feel, ashamed, afraid, enraged, and then what they do, you know, and each one kill themselves either by hanging or drowning or shooting themselves. And then the last stanza makes them more human because one of them was a brother, but, you know, possibly a brother, a cousin, teammate, classmate. And then, you know, that the last line, mama's boy, you know, that also is used as an insult. Mama's boy, you know, you're a mama's boy, which, you know, can mean you're soft, you're weak, which I don't think necessarily you're sensitive is a bad thing. But also mama's boy with a little pause there, right? Because each boy had a mama who was devastated by his death.
Homophobia is something that just doesn't seem to quite go away. I don't know. I think that people are always going to feel self-righteous about their sexual orientation. I'm not even sure that it's sexual orientation. With people who feel like they're in the majority, that they're the right religion or the right sexual orientation or live in the right neighborhood, feel superior to people who don't have the same level of privilege that they do. Or sexual orientation is particularly cruel a lot of times to people, and people are really insensitive about their judgments of other people often.
Well, it's interesting, those two poems really have in them childhood cruelty, right? The one about first death with this little girl being teased, you know, because she's wearing a wig, and then these young men being teased because they're gay or perceived as being gay. And, you know, I've really never understood where this hatred comes from, you know, this intolerance of diversity. You know, I think it comes from people, some people seem to be really afraid of anyone who's different than they are, and they want everybody to think the way they think, act the way they act, dress the way they dress, love the way they love. And wouldn't that be a dull world, you know, if everybody was the same? So, you know, I'm not sure where it comes from. I don't know if I need to understand where it comes from. I know what I need to do is speak out against that kind of hatred and try and do what I can to make the world a safer place for all of us, really.
Yeah, well, I think that poem is, you know, there again, it's very hard-hitting and really accomplishes what you set out to accomplish. Why don't we try A Hair Odyssey?
Sure.
I enjoyed that again because a journey through life with somebody's hair seemed like a little bit of fun there.
Well, you know, my hair, as this poem will demonstrate, has been kind of my trademark my whole life. And so I'll just read the poem, and then I think listeners will hear why. So the poem is called 1955 to 2001, A Hair Odyssey. One, quote, "The day I gave birth to you, you had such beautiful, dark, curly hair. The nurses all took turns combing it. You left the hospital with a ponytail tied up in a pink ribbon, and I was so happy you were a girl, I cried." Two, "I cry every morning before high school because of my hair. My hair, frizz bomb, kinky head, Jufro, the human barometer. Every night I set it on rollers the size of orange juice cans, wrap it around my head with larger than life bobby pins, scotch tape it to my forehead and cheeks, flatten it out along my mother's ironing board, only to have it boing back to its curly, frizzy, kinky Jewish self every single morning. Three, "On a kibbutz in Israel, I live in a room with six other American girls, all of us fascinated by Mona. Mona has straight hair. How does she do it? We watch mesmerized as she divides her waist-length tresses into dozens of sections 1 inch thick and runs the blow dryer up and down each one every morning starting at 4 a.m. in order to be ready for breakfast at 6. 2 hours. Is it worth it? You betcha. The next morning, we are all up at 4 o'clock fighting over the one outlet in the room, having flown halfway around the world just to learn how to straighten our hair. Four, "The first thing I do when I realize I am a lesbian is hack off my hair. The second thing I do is cry. Five, is that a perm? Yes. How long have you had it? 45 years. 6. Out of nowhere, a gray hair, then another, and another. I can't believe it. The words I spat as my mother, as an arrogant teen, come racing back to me. Quote, women shouldn't dye their hair. It's so unnatural, unquote. How did she put up with me? Sitting at the hairdresser's under a stark white light before an unforgiving mirror, a lavender smock draped about my neck, my hair plastered back from my face with cold, wet goo. I look like my mother, vulnerable, exposed, ashamed. 7. Finally, we are friends, my hair and I. My dyed dark brown chin-length hair framing my face in soft curls, sometimes held back with a hairband or clip, sometimes frizzy in the heat, sometimes flat in the cold, always growing, always changing, unruly, unmanageable, unpredictable, like me.
I went bald when I was 21, so I've dealt with a lack of hair as opposed to having unruly hair. Can you get these at any bookstore? Or
they're all published by a wonderful small press called Headmistress Press, which actually is located in Washington.
Thank you very much, Leslie, for coming to Sound Poetry again.
It's always a pleasure to be here. I appreciate our conversation.
You've been listening to Sound Poetry. Our guest today has been Leslie Newman. I'm Steve Niebel, sitting in for David Gilmore.